in charge now.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome. And we're going to call to order today's work program legislative planning committee meeting. First up is the Pledge of Allegiance. And Supervisor Chavez, would you join us or lead us?
Absolutely. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Next up, we have roll call.
Director Brinkman?
Present.
Director Chavez?
Here.
Chair Stone?
I'm here, too.
You have a quorum. Thank you.
I think this is the first time we've been at full strength in a while, so it's very nice. We're all here at the same time. Item number three is public comments on items not on the agenda. This agenda item is for folks who'd like to comment on something that's not specifically detailed in the agenda today, and comments will be limited to 3 minutes, and we are unable, pursuant to the California Brown Act, to give any substantive responses, but we can refer items to staff. Are there any public comment cards?
No.
All right, great. Moving right along to item four, which is approval of the meeting minutes of December 19th, 2019. Is there a motion to approve?
Motion to approve.
Second.
Motion and second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed or abstaining? Motion carries. Item number five, update on decision three of the concept layout for further development as recommended by the Diridon Integrated Station Concept Plan. This is an informational item.
It is.
Okay.
Melissa Reggiardo here. I'm the primary staff person working on the Diridon Integrated Station Concept Plan with our partners, who you know to be BTA, the City of San Jose, as well as High Speed Rail. So I'm here today for a quick informational update regarding the concept plan. To remind you all, in December, we came to the WIPLIP, as well as the board, for concurrence on decisions one and two of the concept plan, which related to the partners' desire and recommendation to pursue an elevated station and one with two concourses, one, of course, at Santa Clara, as well as San Fernando. The DISC partners at that time deferred concurrence on what we have dubbed Decision 3, which revolves around the decision to primarily stay within the existing Caltrain corridor to the north and south of Diridon. And we deferred it because the City Council was planning a study session, which is scheduled for next week, January 28th, where they will fully delve into the many details around this decision. Given that the study session is next week, I want to let you know that our plan is to come back to the JPB to ask for concurrence on Decision 3, pending the city's discussion and followed by the city's decision on Decision 3, which will all occur before the JPB board meeting, if that makes sense. So, purely informational, but just a heads up that you will likely see this item on the consent calendar, assuming that the decision moves through. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Do any of the members of the committee have any questions?
It's really more of a comment, and maybe because I'm newer to the board. Did you all prepare for the Caltrain board just a list of priorities as it related to the Diridon station that you all have?
In terms of how we would...
Prioritize
rail uses.
Well, or even the land availability. And Michelle, part of the reason I'm asking that is that when we had this discussion at the Diridon committee, I know that like VTA has one kind of operational thing that they've been really focused on. And so I was really able to keep saying, hey, what are we going to do with that light rail? Like, where's light rail going to mix into all this? But I don't know what those are for you outside of making sure that you have enough flexibility in terms of train trackage. But I didn't know if there were other external to the trackage, like more of the customer side of it.
Yeah, so we, I will say this, I think what we're doing in terms of, and I think Melissa may talk a little bit about some of the anticipated things that are coming up as the first phase of phase two or phase 1B, which is what we've done is we've broadly identified what we think the footprint is. You're going to jump in if I stray too far afield. And in terms of our presentations to the Caltrain board, those footprint needs have generally been included. We feel they've also been included as part of understanding that all of the operations planning that's been done through the business plan has been fully incorporated into the DISC process. And so those things are absolutely synced up. So at this point, we have a relatively large footprint, both in terms of rail infrastructure as well as platforming and station houses and all that. Now, I will say, this board has not had a highly detailed presentation about what we think about square footage for this or platform widths or anything like that, because we're getting to that as part of this phase two.
But I think, Michelle, I'm asking for something a little more basic, which is that since all of us sit on different boards, I would just, if you said, look, here are the five things you need to make sure we keep repeating and that are really clear. And like I said, I've picked up my own mantra for VTA. I don't have that same level of, you better make sure, you know, so I just, if you gave us that, it wouldn't even need to be a presentation. It may have been something old and internal that you wrote that you just want to clean up enough to send out. That's really all I was asking.
No, that's
yeah,
perfect.
Thank you.
Any other questions or concerns?
I just want to say thank you for suggesting that, because it's good for all of us to have a common page that
we're singing off of.
Has some bullet points.
Elevator speech.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it.
And as the only member of the Diridon Joint Policy Advisory Committee, not from that region of the world down there, that would be really helpful to me too. All right. Let's see here. Moving right along, we have item number 6. Which is the recommended adoption of the Caltrain Rail Corridor Use Policy, affectionately known as the RCUP.
Okay, great. Melissa Jones is not here, so I'm going to be presenting this briefly. Director Brinkman, you'll excuse me for not going through the voluminous presentation that was given at the last board meeting. I thought it was really, really good in terms of getting the whole board up to speed on the good work that's been done through this committee to get RCUP moving forward. I will say, you know, you will have in front of you a fully revised policy, and apologize for not having it to you in red line capacity, whatever that red line. I think there's a couple of things that we wanted to address at this meeting by way of what we hope will satisfy some of the very valid comments that were received last time. And it's also really important, I think, to emphasize, and this is something that was mentioned as part of the policy update. You know, we've always talked about these four policy documents that were working concurrently. We talked about the station toolbox, we talked about the TOD policy, we've talked about the business plan, and we've also talked about the RCUP, Rail Corridor Use Policy. What we kind of took for granted as staff is that for a long time we've had a policy of property conveyance that's rather thorough, that includes a fee schedule, and it includes limitlimitations on length of term of lease and what needs to come to the board and not. And I think what we understood as staff and want to convey, Director Chavez, in part as part of some of your good comments, is that conveyance policy as part of the adoption of RCUP and to some degree also as part of the discussion around TOD, it needs to be updated and needs to be brought back to this board. In part to deal with the concerns around making sure that there aren't five-year, because as part of that, there is the statement that leases over 5 years will be brought back to this board. Well, there's a sort of a condition in which you could have a 5-year lease that then gets extended, and we want to make sure, if I have the question right, we want to make sure that those leases do come back to the board, that it's not like kind of this thing that gets extended and suddenly you've got a 20-year lease that hasn't been approved by the board. So we want to be very clear that that is the document and the policy within which we would like to make that change, because there are a bunch of other changes that we also feel are warranted. And so I'm bringing that up at this point because what we did and what we thought would be acceptable to this committee would be that we would certainly refer to that policy within the document and within the resolution that would approve the RCUP. But we wanted some time, and when I say some time, we're not talking about a long time, but basically, you know, let's call it no more than 6 months I think Brian is screaming at me at that point, but no more than 6 months to come back to this committee with a full markup of that policy that would then be able to be referred to from the RCUP, so we could make changes in one place, the property conveyance policy, and that would filter through all of the other real estate related and property related policies instead of us having to go through each policy and update them and have concerns about having inconsistencies between policies. So I want to put that out there for your consideration as the means through which we thought we might be able to deal with not only Director Chavez, the issue that you brought up and what should be a valid concern for the committee and the board as a whole, but also so we could bring back the policy to point out, hey, these are all of the other changes that we think are warranted, given that, you know, we're trying to make the best and highest use of these really important assets. So for your consideration, I just want to run through a couple of the other changes that were made. I'm going to reference pages in the policies. I'm not going to talk for too much longer. I also want to point out that it's only 200 pages. And
but this one, is this a different one?
That is a revised from what was presented in December. I'll point out the major revisions, and they're relatively modest, but I think they're meaningful in terms of addressing the concerns. And so let me just run through this again rather quickly. First of all, again, really appreciate the time that the board was able to spend on understanding what has been what we think is a really thorough body of work. And there was, again, I think, in addition to the property conveyance comment, issues around allowable uses and ensuring that the RCUP would very specifically deal with issues around grade separation projects and joint development projects that would be integrated with capital projects in the overview of the allowable uses table. So if you go to page 8 in the new policy, we have referenced the need specifically to integrate, certain opportunities, joint development with capital projects. And we've also, we think, dealt with, the issue that we wanted to deal with very specifically, which is to make mention of, so there's an understanding that we're going to seek to exploit, maybe not a great word, but use air rights as much as possible, as integrated into these projects. So there are some very specific changes on between 8 through 14, and I'll just point them out very specifically as an example on page 8. In the third paragraph down, it talks about in general future capital projects, parentheses, including vehicular grade separation projects, and parentheses for the railroad, are considered non-railroad uses and are generally exempt from the RCUP's review process, and it goes on. I'm not going to go through all of these changes, but we will provide for a strike-through.
That would be really great.
We'll provide for a strike-through in the general board packet, so you'll see very specifically what was changed. I think the other thing that is really important, through strike through, so I don't want to go through this too much, is that generally on page 7, which is the section, or rather 6, that deals with the step-by-step of the overview and decision-making process. That's where we've really made reference to JPB's policy of property conveyance. We've also committed in this policy document to update that property conveyance policy, and that's in the strike-through. And then finally, the one other additional change is that the rezo itself includes a direction requested from staff that the board direct us to update that property conveyance policy. Not as smooth as Melissa Jones, but just wanted to sort of provide for you those changes that we can do that, but it's the idea is so after on page 8 you've got allowable non-railroad uses, and then it goes into the actual charts where it goes through some detail of what is allowable in every single applicable place. We've included the use of hotels, which was requested to be included, and also air rights. And it's in every single place where it's applicable in commercial and development uses. So, again, we'll provide a strike through of that, so it'll be really easy for you to be able to pick up where the changes are. We have made no changes to the maps. They serve as is, according to the descriptions of the different types of uses and the overlay. I'm here to answer any questions you may have. Anything I can't answer, I, of course, will kick over to Sebastian. Up to you.
Okay, any questions or concerns from members of the committee? Director Chavez.
I was just going to say, I do... Two things. One is it would be fabulous to get the strike through for the meeting, and I appreciate everybody's working hard, and so that'll get done. I do want to say how much I appreciate the work done and the background and helping me understand like what goes in a policy and what, you know, administrative code versus what goes in these documents. The one request I would like to make is as we proceed where we have these kinds of disconnected, I mean, they're not disconnected, where you have multiple policies. I notice that on occasion in some documents that I read, you reference where I could find the other, and in others, it's a little harder to find. And so when this comes to the board for just a final vote, I would just make sure that the cover memorandum includes the significant changes that you made along with the compendium documents, along with the timeline, so that that timeline, as everybody's looking at, we're setting expectations for, for what next steps are and what the timing would be. And really appreciate the staff work. And I will say to my colleagues, I got an offline explanation, so I didn't lose my hair, as I say to my dog, keep your fur on, so I was ready for today without. And I appreciated it. Thank you.
Director Brinkman.
Thank you. I also just want to thanks to the other members of this committee. You guys got a lot done the meeting that I missed, and I won't take that personally, but thank you for getting so much done when I wasn't
correlation
here.
Correlation is not always causation.
Exactly. And thank you to staff. This is such a huge step forward, and when I first joined the board, I know this was something that was talked about, like, you know, can we see what property we have and what the potential is to do something with it? And I really grew to understand that until we had our business plan mapped out and until we knew what direction we were going in and what we wanted to do with the railroad, we couldn't do that. And now we have this document that shows us really what there is to work with and what we can do. And I really look forward to seeing what we do with some of these properties. And the whole idea of the air rights is just fascinating to me. I think that's going to be, that's going to be really interesting to watch. So thank you, and thanks to all of the staff who worked on this. Really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, I echo the comments of gratitude. This has been quite a slog, and I'm really appreciative of the work that Brian and his team has done. It may have happened after I left the Caltrain board meeting earlier this month because I had a work obligation. But how did hotels come up, and what's the thought process behind allowing hotels as a use?
So this was a comment from Director Bruins, and I think the idea was, she was like, well, you know, you have very specific other things like museums, and sort of, you know, then
you
why are we excluding certain other things? And I think, you know, she brought up hotels as what we thought was a really good thing to also include specifically. And so that's where we ended up incorporating it. It was a concern from Director Bruins.
I guess what I'm trying to wrap my mind around is I certainly understand that hotels are lucrative, and cities love them because of the TOT. But I'm trying to think of a location where a hotel would be appropriate within our corridor where housing wouldn't be. And I can't. And because of that, I'm having a hard time getting to a point where I could be supportive of including hotels as an allowable use. Because if there's a place where a hotel could go, it tells me that's a place where housing could go, and I think we need to prioritize housing in those places. But if I'm getting any of that wrong, somebody tell me.
So if I could jump in here. So I think the intent of RCUP is simply to talk about allowable uses. And I think, again, when we talk about TOD and other policy and other process, that's where we would decide what uses for a specific location would be reviewed as acceptable by this board and recommended by staff. So this in no way is saying you must have hotels here. It's saying it's a possibility. But right, you'll see we also have in here offices, residences, retail space, hotels.
Sure, and I understand that.
Okay.
But I guess what I'm saying is I can't think of any place a hotel could go or housing couldn't go. And what I'm saying is as a policy document, in that case, this should make no reference to hotels as an allowable use because we need to prioritize housing. I don't want this agency to have to face even the decision between a hotel that may be more lucrative and housing. Now, if it's the case that there are simply locations along the corridor where a hotel could go and housing wouldn't be appropriate, I'd like to hear that. That would alter the way I think about it. But so far, I'm not hearing that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. And maybe if I can ask a question, Michelle, that might help me. Because I look at this as imagining possibilities in the future that we can't imagine today. And including air rights, for example, we haven't analyzed what that really is going to mean. We just reference it so people think of the possibility. And there may be something 10 years from now, after, you know, in conjunction with a capital project, where it would just appear evident that nothing should be built in the air rights there, or the only thing suitable should be X. I don't know what that X will be, but I think this is just perhaps a way of saying, let's leave no stone unturned as we look at, in the future to what these things may be. And it's not that it would be a choice between a hotel and an office or a hotel and residence. It's just it can be one of the allowable uses. And so I guess I feel like I'm constrained by my own lack of imagination. I don't know when that possibility might arise. But I think a museum might be something that could be a residence as well. But, you know, there might be, you know, I don't know what the trade-offs are there. So I think we're just trying to accommodate the future in some way. And the choices will be made at the point in time when something could be available.
I guess the way I think about it is, for all the other uses, that makes a lot of sense to me because I don't think there's going to be a location where a museum would be appropriate or a car repair shop would be appropriate. There's a trade-off with housing, but hotels are so similar in terms of the circumstances that would make them appropriate for a location to housing that it in my mind does create a potential trade-off no matter what. And so I may be the only one of the nine that wants this, but I don't want hotels to be in allowable use because I figure, and I am the first one to admit that I have a tremendous lack of imagination at all times. But if by some, you know, stroke of luck in 20 years, we've got the housing crisis solved and it's affordable to live here and people making, you know, starting teacher salaries and starting bus operator salaries can live here with no problem, a future board can simply alter the RCUP at that time to allow hotels. But that's just the way I think about it. Director Chavez.
Thank you. And I appreciate the whole place of imagination in this. And so let me just make an observation of something that I've been really intrigued by. As we start to think about grade separations, and I think what that's going to give us an opportunity to do is think about the footprint of Caltrain in a much bigger way, and may even on occasion put us in a position where we have to expand and buy land for those footprints. In some instances, and I'll just give you an example, you may have somebody who wants to develop an office. They're willing to put money into the project, and the partner property they'd be interested in is a hotel because they can share a parking lot but still make money on the air rights. And for us, that's money that would come back, obviously, to this organization. You know, the other thing is I think there may be opportunities where it makes more sense for short-term housing, which may be like a Marriott's and a Suites. It's a week, you know, weekly rental or even daily rental because it's proximate to something that's extremely noisy that we wouldn't put housing on. But again, building that may allow us, and again, I'm thinking about the future, that maybe there's some open space between that, a hotel open space and housing, because the housing would be further away from whatever the noise generation is. And so one of the things I think we have to think about are who are the possible partners that allow us to expand the amount of space that we could actually even build upon. So that's what I was thinking about, because I had the same reaction you did, which is, I actually, even what you just said out loud is what I was saying to myself in my head. And then I was thinking about some of the developments that I've seen in other places. And I also recognize that I'm kind of fascinated by the idea of us taking the grade separations kind of to a whole nother level. And the more I've been thinking about those, the more I've been thinking about all the places I've seen them and what's been built around and on top of them. And what someone told me as I was talking to them a little bit about the RCUP, don't ask me why, but I was more intrigued with the way you all do business. And they said, what a foolish thing to think. They were saying to me that, like, you could spend the rest of your life talking about what could happen on the peninsula. It's still the peninsula. Nothing will ever happen here. And I said, God, you know, I mean, well, I think what they meant was from a height perspective. And my point to them was, with sea level rise, with just demands on what the economic infrastructure may require us, our, you know, those who come after us to think about, that we have to really build the broadest platform for them to be able to act upon. And so that's why I thought the thing about hotels that was interesting to me is it's opportunistic, because I've seen it benefit other kinds of developments that I've been more interested in the past. That's why when she said it, again, I processed it the same way you did, because I'm kind of jealously guarding land for housing. But then I thought, wait a minute, they could help us build an interchange. They could help us build a grade sep. Huh. I don't mind taking money from them.
And those are really good points. I can't get there.
Yeah, I hear you.
I get it. I can't get there. It's too severe a crisis of affordability for me to get there. But again, sounds like I'll be in the minority, and that's totally fine. Other than that, I think it's phenomenal. Director Brinkman.
It is a good thing to bring up, though, because as you said, a future board could add it or take it away. And it's hard for me to imagine a board in the next 5-10 years saying, oh, yes, a hotel's a better use than housing. So I think, you know, like my fellow director, I think I will trust that the future boards will be in the same place we are, because you're right. I can't imagine that we're going to have the affordability crisis solved in the next however many years. But I have faith in our future boards. So I'm actually happy to leave the hotels in there, because I think you bring up a good point. It does open up some interesting ideas. I stayed at a hotel in Japan a decade ago that was just built across the railroad tracks. And it had shopping, and it had restaurants, and it had a hotel, and you know, it was fabulous. Would you want to live there? Maybe not full time, but boy, as a tourist, it was fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that in Amsterdam too, where they had an office building and a hotel right next to each other. And you couldn't tell the difference between them, but they were two separate developments on what seemed to me, I can't even imagine being the developer, it felt like it was this big. I was like, oh, my God, how are you up there? But, yeah.
Get those people out of here ASAP.
Right.
All right. We need to take action on this. Okay. So I will call for a motion. Hold on. We've got, looks like comments. A public speaker. And folks, I encourage everyone at any meeting I chair, please turn your cards in early.
Okay.
Drew? Public commenter Drew?
All right.
Thank you, Drew. Sorry.
Good afternoon, Drew.
Good afternoon. I honestly thought there was going to be some public comments on this based on past meetings, so that's kind of why I was waiting for you to call it. So I'm sorry about the hesitation on all around here. So in the context of what was just presented, as far as there's going to be an update coming that's going to incorporate a few more things in the future, about 6 months from now, I bring up two things potentially to be included. One of those is, and I brought this up vaguely in the past, is this whole idea around set out tracks. If you're aware of the city of San Mateo, this is an extremely heated discussion right now. It might lead to a lawsuit against Caltrain based on what I've been hearing and stuff, if it goes through. And so in the context of the business plan and this land use, identifying quickly over the corridor where potential set out tracks would go and could go based on, it's very easy, you know, there's very easy dimensions for what this would do. And in a revision, just to start having that planned out instead of it's just kind of happenstance in the future. And I think that's part of the battle in San Mateo. It's like, you know, this whole thing about doing it. And the irony in San Mateo is in 15, 20 years, we're going to rip it out if it gets built in that general area, because between Great Sept through downtown, it's going to need that space for shoe fly tracks or stuff. And the elevation or the passing tracks for the business plan. So it's like, it just seems conceptually that that's something that could be included in a future update. And that's why I bring it up and stuff. It's not to stop the current process at all. And then the other thing would just be how the maps get updated at some point, if that got incorporated. Because like in Hillsdale Station, there's station right away, that's parking lots today. And it's not coded in the maps that way on the west side. People will park in that. It's the only station in the entire corridor that's miscoded. And so those west side parking lots are coded as just general use. But in reality, they're going to get used as parking lots. And the east side parking lots, all the new stuff with passing tracks, will get wiped out. 400-something spots will be wiped out if we do passing tracks. So those parking lots currently on the west side should be identified as station right away and stuff. Again, don't hold up this current process, but I think revising that map to reflect that's a station property. And then, you know, through whatever development, then it can be analyzed correctly and stuff. So thank you.
Thank you, Drew. I'll leave it to staff to respond to the issues with mapping if they feel they need to at some point in the future. I appreciate your comments about the set-out track. I will simply say that I think that it is a good idea to have an idea of where those might go. I just don't think the R-Cup is the right place for it, because it's more aimed at bigger real estate uses, not train uses. Does that make sense? Yeah, not operation uses by Caltrain. But I think it is a good idea to have foresight in that regard. Okay, with that, is there a motion?
Motion to approve.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed or abstaining? The motion carries. Thank you. Next up, we have the recommended adoption of the transit-oriented development policy. Welcome, Mr. Fitzpatrick.
Good afternoon, Chair Stone, members of the committee. This is a continuation, and if... Oh, I need the clicker.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay. I have a hard enough time using this as it is, so now I have to learn it while walking. So this is a continuation of an item that we had brought before this committee in January, and we got about a little bit more than halfway through the meeting, And we had a hard stop. We had to move. So what I'm going to try to do here is I'm going to try to highlight some things that we talked about in January, but not, you know, redo the whole thing. So I'm going to try to get through that little needle hole of giving you the right amount of background, but also not going back over already plowed ground. Then we're going to jump into some stuff that we were in the middle of. When the meeting stopped, where we're going to kind of discuss a typical TOD and talk about some things that impact whether it's economically feasible and what the economics are of a transaction. We're going to present a staff recommendation for the affordable housing component of the TOD policy. And then we're going to ask you to look at the TOD policy, which has been in our agenda packet last time and is in there again this time. And we're going to ask the WIPLIP to recommend for board adoption in February 2020. So that's kind of what we plan on doing today. So again, I'm going to hit a couple things that I think were highlights from our meeting in January. What is the TOD policy? TOD policy is a board-adopted policy that expresses our, as an agency's, goals and strategic objectives for joint development on its property, right? That's why we're doing this whole thing, and that's why this is a vital component of all the work we've been doing with the RCUP and everything else. And it's going to apply to properties that we own, obviously, and we're going to talk about properties that are available for development independent from a capital project. I think, as Director Chavez noted, it's a totally different ballgame when you're integrating something with the development of a grade separation or something else. Totally different thinking. So we're talking, you know, about those things. Now, if you all will recall, what we've been trying to do these last, I think we've had 5 total meetings with the board and with this committee. And what we've been trying to do is to elicit good discussion from this committee and from the board, turn that into something that we write in a concise, objective manner, and then feed it back to you and get you to nod your head back and say, yep, that's where we want it to go. So it's my objective that when you see things that we've written down, both in the policy and reflecting conversations we've had, you're going to look at it and go, yep, that's what we talked about. That's our objective, is to hear what the board has to say and turn that into a policy. So a couple things that we talked about in the last WIPLIP that had happened in the previous WIPLIP to that were some of these highlights here, right? One, it's important to maximize development potential. Work with cities, private partners, nonprofits to maximize what we can do on our sites. Second thing that I think has played throughout
your
all this.
Time's up.
So last time I had an hour, now I've got 3 minutes.
Yeah. Sorry.
You're almost there.
Go ahead.
Give him another 3 minutes.
I can probably do it in like 23, if that's on the timer. We learned that you know, I learned from you that you agree with staff that, you know, if possible, that long-term leases with revenue participation makes sense. We want to retain control of our property where it's possible. We also talked about flexibility in some other discussions because we have unique property holdings. And then we talked a lot about complete communities. And what do we mean by that? And these are things that are direct responses from the board, right? Avoid hard and fast rules about mixed use. Like sometimes you say, hey, we can have ground floor retail in everything we do. Maybe we don't. Work with communities to ensure that the use on JPB property makes sense on that community. And complete communities reduce the need for private automobiles, right? And when I think of this, I have a little note here. Director Brinkman had a comment that rings in my mind, which is, you know, hey, if a neighborhood needs a grocery store, maybe we bring that to the table with our development. Keeps people out of a car because they can live and be in their community. And it's something that works with the community. It increases that concept of partnership. So, you know, those are things that we heard there. So that's kind of what we did last time. And then where we were when we came to the end of our meeting was we had talked about the cost of affordability. And for some reason, I don't know why this keeps happening on this screen with this computer, but if you look on your printed policy, your printed PowerPoint, you will see what all these dots mean. But basically, when we started our discussion about
affordability. What we talked about is there are two components of affordability, right? Your target income range, which is represented on the up and down axis on this graph, and then the percentage of affordability. So what level of affordability is provided is on one side, and how much, how many units is provided on the bottom. And what we did is we showed a number of cities on here, and I'll just give you a little bit of an example, and I apologize again. I don't know what's up with our computer, but you know, this is Burlingame. They've got a fairly low level of affordability and a fairly low number of units they create. Down in the, right up here in blue, that's San Francisco. They require 20% of units, and they require a fairly deep level of affordability. And then down here, these two squares, those are our partners at VTA and JPB. When they've set TOD policies, this is what their policies say that they should create in as a minimum in every project that they do. So this table is just to give a little bit of context for, you know, how other cities deal with affordability and how transit agencies deal with affordability. And why is this important? Is because we are saying, do we want to create more affordability than is required by the city? Do we want to require more than baseline? So we thought it was interesting for you to see how cities view baseline and how other transit agencies address that issue.
Do you mind if we jump in with a question?
As long as the timer's not on.
It's not. Director Chavez.
So, actually, let me see if you answer it. I'll jump in if you don't.
She's changed her mind.
Yeah, thank you. Go ahead.
I may very well answer it. So, so then we talked a little bit last time about economic impacts of affordable housing. And the way that we talked about this slide is we call this the "what can Caltrain do" slide. In other words, if we ourselves want to provide a level of affordability above and beyond what is required in the specific city we're developing in, what is that going to cost us? And what we did is we said, look, we had strategic economics come up and create a typical TOD project. We have a project that's got 100 units and it's got 15% below market rate. We're living in a city that has a baseline affordability requirement of 15%, and we have low and very low, split 50-50 in terms of who gets this affordability. And we say, hey, Caltrain is living in that city all by ourselves. What can we do? And we basically said, well, let's say this project brings in about $10 million of revenue, right? Net present value. If we were just to provide extra affordability, what would that do? And basically what we said would be if we were to be in a situation like this, we had a project that generated $10 million worth of revenue, and we ourselves decided to provide additional affordability, the revenue we would create from that project for ourselves would drop. Makes sense. Less revenue for us. So this is simply to say, if Caltrain wanted to provide additional levels of affordability, what would it cost us? And that's kind of what we talked about here in this slide. And again, I think the takeaway from my perspective in this is simply, you know, it creating additional levels of affordability is going to have a cost. And we learned that at the Hayward Park project, where this agency decided to, on its own, double the amount of affordability that was required by the city of San Mateo. We doubled it, and we took a revenue hit to do that. So this agency's seen that before. We've seen transactions. This is just to look at it on a more broad basis. This is what it would cost us. Again, in the absence of other partners, in the absence of doing other things, that's what affordability costs. So now, one of the things that happened in our last discussion, Director Chavez said, I've never seen a project before that doesn't have multiple partners that creates affordable housing. And we agree with that, right? And one of the things that you'll see in the policy that we've put forward is we state very explicitly that we want to be encouraged by our policy to partner with affordable housing developers as appropriate to create, you know, affordability. But we also want to talk a little bit about, you know, what does it mean to do affordability? Because the reason you have many partners is because the world is different based on the site, based on the economic conditions, and based on where you are in the world. So, for example, the size of the funding gap to create affordability is always going to change. Right now, we're in a world where rents are very, very high. Construction costs are very, very high. So we're in a situation where high development costs are impacting feasibility of all types of projects, right? So the gap is going to shift. How much money we need to find to create affordability in creative ways is going to shift around. The extent to which additional outside funds may be available to support affordable housing, again, varies. And I'll give you an example. We were concerned when we did Hayward Park that we were asking the developer to use tax credit financing. We were concerned at that time that the impacts of the new Trump tax cuts may make investors in such tax credits harder to come by. And we wanted to make sure that we weren't setting the developer up to try to build a project that was unbuildable. Our decision was building something better than not building it. There are local sources. There's Measure A in Santa Clara County, Measure K in San Mateo. Of course, those funding sources are always going to change. They're going to have different names, different sources. Hopefully, they're going to become more plentiful, and they're going to be easier to get. And then the third point we wanted to make is we may be, in some instances, and I think this is what both Director Stone and Chavez said in the last meeting, is our projects may, in some instances, be easier to get affordable financing because of where we're located and different things. Not always, but you know, we may have some advantages. So that's just sort of some general concepts about, you know, how we've gone about thinking about where we want to land on this. Now, I'm going to ask you all to stop thinking about affordable housing for a second and think about a couple other economic factors that I think are vitally important. So our transit-oriented development sites are not easy to develop, and they're not standard sites. Most other people who own land don't have to build other things on that land when they're doing development. But as a transit agency, when we go to develop land, we need to make sure that we have goals that are not only for development of the land, but to make sure that we provide sufficient access. And that's a balance of access. We need to make sure we have access for shuttle buses. We have to make sure we have connections for bike and ped and these other things. Sometimes we may need to build replacement parking, right? If we're building on a parking lot, and I will tell you that a large majority of the sites that we're looking at, well, both of the two big sites we're looking at are parking lots, we're going to have to think about how much replacement parking needs to be at those sites, right? And we've been lucky thus far. At Hayward Park, we're not requiring any replacement parking. Samtrans, when it built this project out here, was able to replace parking on the surface, not in a structure. But replacement parking is going to drive the economics of any deal we do. And the reason that this is important in this discussion is we want to make sure that we create the right balance of policies so that we don't put ourselves in a position where we're economically unable to do transactions because replacement parking is high or other things are out there. So what we did is we talked about a project, that same project where we've got our 85 units, but now we have to create parking for JPB, right? And so when we create parking, and in this case, we are creating 60 replacement parking spots, right? What we've done is we've reduced our revenue in two ways. That $10 million is reduced because now I can't build as many units because I have to put the parking somewhere, and I have to pay $65,000 a parking spot. So that $10 million revenue that the agency was going to derive from our hypothetical project, it's now gone down to about 4.1 because we have this parking replacement. And again, this is a necessary thing that we need to do in certain developments, depending on what our future parking looks like. So there are a lot of economic factors here that we need to look at. Last thing I want to point out here is JPB sites are unique. One of the other reasons that they're unique is that they're former railroad sites, right? We bought all this property or from Southern Pacific Railroad, who had been operating this railroad since 1863. What does that mean? That means that oftentimes we have encountered hazardous materials on our sites. That doesn't mean sites are not developable, but what does it mean? It means really two things. One, if a site is too dirty, we might not be able to build certain things on that site, right? Or building of certain things may be cost prohibitive because you have to clean it to a certain level. And if the development doesn't generate enough revenue to offset those costs, it may dictate what we need or can do on that site. Secondly, we are responsible, obviously, for the condition of our property. So again, just as replacement parking creates a hit on property value, it's entirely possible that if we have to clean a site up, we're going to have another hit on property value. So an example is in Hayward Park, we have a $2 million cap on our hazmat obligation. We're hoping to be way below that, but you know that's money that comes off the top of any lease. So when we're looking at balancing business terms to do TOD, we need to keep in mind that we have some uniqueness here, and we're going to recommend that we try to develop business terms that don't preclude us from development. Does that all make sense? So all this is to say that staff is going to make a recommendation that in every transit-oriented development we do that includes housing, that we create housing at an affordable level of 20%, and we want that to be split evenly between low and very low-income households, which means if we were to do this independently, we would, you know, take a revenue hit that's sort of right in the middle here, 20%. We'd take about a $3 million revenue hit. It doesn't mean we would on every deal because we're going to try to find creative ways and financing the gap and working with partners to do it. But we're going to recommend that level of affordability. And sort of the punchline here on my graph that doesn't work is we're going to be right in the middle between where VTA and BART are. That's what our recommendation is that we're consistent with what other transit agencies have done and what's tried and true. So that's what staff is going to recommend. And what does this mean? So this gives us a lot of ways to work, right? It gives us the opportunity to partner with private developers who meet the requirement with a mixed income project. That's kind of what we've been talking about. It gives us the ability to partner with affordable housing developers and leverage other funds to create more affordability, to go up to 100%. Like Director Chavez and Stone have said, you never see these projects without multiple partners. We can partner with both a conventional developer and an affordable developer to potentially split a site if we had sites that were, you know, big enough to do so. And then the kicker here that I want to make sure we say is, at board discretion, right? At board discretion, this isn't my decision. We wouldn't want it to be a staff decision. We want it to be a board decision that we have the flexibility to accept reduced revenues in exchange for creating affordable units. Now, this is stuff that you're not going to see put out that directly on other agencies' policies. We're going to say, if this is what we want to do and we come to you with an affordable project, we're going to ask that we be in a position to be able to legitimately talk to the board about balancing how we take our revenue, whether it's in dollars, parking, affordable housing. We want to balance that the right way. So basically, what's our recommendation? We require residential TOD to provide affordable housing on site. We'd require a minimum of 20% of affordable units. We'd want 10% to very low, and then the remainder of those affordable units to no more than 80% of AMI, area median income. We don't recommend a portfolio-wide goal because we only have two sites. So it doesn't make sense to say, hey, let's do a portfolio-wide goal. Let's do a per-project goal. We want to partner with developers to leverage other sources of affordable housing funds. And finally, we're going to explore creative ways to use smaller and less conventional sites to find affordable housing. So that's sort of our recommendation. So we've appeared to you four times before today. The policy includes feedback. We just had a little discussion about the one thing that we hadn't really talked about in depth before besides last meeting, which is affordability. I'd like to recommend that we have a little discussion about the policy before you and what we just talked about. And then obviously what we're going to do is seek a recommendation that this be adopted by the board of directors.
All right. Thank you, Brian. That was great. We have a couple of comment cards. Are there? What I'd like to do is take clarifying questions and then have members of the public who want to speak, and then the committee members will give their comments. Are there any clarifying questions from members of the committee? I have one. In this same spirit of imagination that we talked about earlier, doesn't it make sense to have a portfolio-wide goal?
We've thought a little bit about that. And one of the reasons that we're recommending against that, there's about three of them. The underlying concept is when we have really two sites we're effectively working with, the thought is, hey, if we want to have a higher goal, let's set a higher goal and try to target it to those sites. Because what I wouldn't want to do is set a portfolio-wide goal and set something that we're not going to be able to make. In other words, if we've got two sites and we end up with one at 20% and we assume the other one's going to be 50 or 60% to get to that portfolio-wide goal and we undershoot, then we haven't achieved our goal. So my objective would be, or my encouragement would be, that we set a goal for the portfolio, and if we feel that that goal is too low, I'd rather just shoot for it per project rather than do a portfolio-wide goal, again, because I don't want to set something that we're not going to meet. Because typically what agencies will do is when they have a lot of sites, they'll say, well, you know, throughout time on our 20 sites, we can find the right sites to do 100% affordable. We can find the right sites to do, you know, more conventional, and they'll sort of balance it out. With a limited number of sites, that's a harder thing to do. It feels like it's setting us up for failure.
Okay, I'll have some comments on that later. Any other questions? All right, we have two comment cards so far. Now we have four, exponentially more.
The first two speakers, please line up, is Karen Camacho and Paul Krupka.
Good afternoon. Karen Camacho with the Housing Leadership Council of San Mateo County. We're a nonprofit whose mission is to produce and preserve quality affordable homes in San Mateo County. First of all, I would like to thank both the committee and staff for all of your work in putting this TOD policy together. As I was reviewing it earlier today, I noticed that the actual text of the TOD policy was not posted online, but now I had the chance to read it in person with the printed copies. And I want to say that we're very happy with the added changes, which include one, requiring residential TOD to provide affordable housing on-site, and requiring a minimum of 20% below market rate units, which is in alignment with other transit agencies. Two, encouraging partnerships with affordable housing developers to leverage other sources of funding. And three, exploring creative ways to partner with adjacent parcels to utilize smaller opportunity sites for affordable housing. So we're really grateful for those changes. And some of the changes that we would still like to see in the policy include, one, a right of first refusal to affordable housing developers. That means that any developable land, as determined by the RCUP zones 2 and 3, should be offered for lease to nonprofit developers. And if that does not work, it can be offered to market rate developers with a 20% inclusionary requirement. And two, have specific height and density minimums and parking maximums rather than a broad statement such as stated in the TOD policy of, quote, maximize development potential, end quote. So this can be something like a minimum of 75 units per parcel, per acre, and a minimum height of 4 stories, as well as a maximum parking of 1 space per acre, per unit. So thank you again for all of your work, and we really appreciate all the time that you've spent on putting this policy together. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Stone and members of the committee. My name is Paul Krupka. I'm a San Mateo, long-term San Mateo resident and a transportation consultant. And first, I'd like to say thank you, for your dedication to Caltrain. I think that as a longtime county resident and user of Caltrain, I see a very bright future for Caltrain based upon all the work that you do, all the work that staff does, and all the work that the community does to support and make better this system. I think that the TOD policy and the RCUP, I love these acronyms, RCUP, TOD, cup runneth over, oops, and the RCUP that guides it are critical to the mission of the railroad. I was lucky to be involved in some recent meetings with Brian Fitzpatrick, Melissa Jones, and Jessica Epstein. And I just want to thank them directly for all their good work. These are consummate professionals, dedicated, and very, very astute. And I just want to say thank you. I'm very impressed with the work on this aspect of your railroad. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Next speaker.
The next speaker is Jonathan Irwin Frank, and the last speaker is Roland.
I'm Jonathan Irwin Frank. I'm a housing attorney at Community Legal Services in East Palo Alto. So we're a legal services organization that does work in a number of areas, including housing and eviction defense. So we're on the front lines observing the tragic human cost of the housing crisis. I was one of the co-authors of a letter that was sent a few hours ago, and I wanted to thank you all for all the work that you've done on this and to staff for getting that printed and ready on such short notice. So I really appreciate that. I wanted to respond to the contention that projects covered by the RCUP and the TOD would not be subject to the Surplus Land Act that I believe was made at the prior meeting of this committee. And to ask that, as both a legal and a policy matter, the Surplus Land Act is and should be a floor in terms of the affordable housing commitment for Caltrain. As some background information, this is laid out in more detail in the letter, there were recent amendments last year strengthening the Surplus Land Act that demonstrate the commitment of the state and the state legislature to affordable housing on public land. And one of the things that those amendments did was clarify that the Surplus Land Act applies to local agencies that include joint powers boards, among other things. And as is laid out in more detail in the letter, the Surplus Land Act should properly be construed to apply to all land that is no longer directly controlled by the local agency and serving the primary goal, in this case, transportation. And so that would mean something like safety or electrical infrastructure, not housing simply because people would be in close proximity to trains. And so what does the Surplus Land Act do? It requires that a local agency disposing, selling, or leasing land give first priority to and enter into good faith negotiations with entities that propose to make at least 25% of the total number of units affordable, and give priority to those that provide the greatest number of affordable units at the deepest level of affordability. And as we stated in the letter and in prior comments regarding the Hayward Park project, we firmly believe that the Surplus Land Act applies here, but nonetheless, we hope that Caltrain would consider its obligation to serve all residents and would look at that act as a floor rather than a ceiling. And, you know, I'll echo what Karen said. I do appreciate the 20%. I think that Caltrain could go even further. and go up to 25%, and then especially important, and echoing the Surplus Land Act, make a...
I'm going to have to ask you to finish
up. First refusal.
Thank you. And do we have any speakers after this speaker? Now would be the time to turn your card in, if we do. Welcome.
Good afternoon. So, is this working?
Yeah.
It is. So we basically are back to the conversation we started last year with Hayward Park. About what's our mission statement here? Is it to increase ridership? Is it to decrease congestion between San Jose and San Francisco? Are we in the business of making sweet deals for developers? So let's go back and look at this. This example, increasing the number of below market rate units beyond baseline, cost the agency $200,000 for moderate, $500,000 for low income, and $700,000 for very low income unit. Are you kidding me? Are you serious? And then look at another one. Where is it? Where's the parking? There we go. Including replacement parking has two impacts. The JPB must reimburse the development cost of parking, $65,000 per parking space. Do you want to watch the VTA board meeting where the VTA equivalent of the gentleman came up and said it was $40,000 per parking space and what the board response was? So, you know, we're just chasing our tails here. And at the end of the day, we have got to cut the chase. And the bottom line is that Samtrans is totally unfit as the managing agency for Caltrain. And the sooner we address that, the better, because, you know, we're not getting anywhere here.
All right. Any other comment cards? Okay, before we get to board comments and further questions, I did want to give Mr. Fitzpatrick a chance to respond to any of the comments he'd like to, especially there was a comment I heard from one speaker that you had said the Surplus Land Act doesn't apply, and my recollection is that you didn't say that at all, and so I want to give you a chance to clear that up.
I think that the general counsel might be better.
All right.
Equipped to,
right. We have never taken the position the Surplus Land Act does not apply. We review this act very carefully. It has been a moving target, as Jonathan suggested. There has been a lot of amendments in the last year or two, and I understand that there are going to be more amendments coming forward, probably in the next legislative session. So we watch it closely, and I assure you that we don't take any steps that I believe would constitute a legal violation of the Surplus Land Act. Having said that, I think that this is an area that is steeped in policy. I mean, this is really affordability. And what this agency determines is most appropriate to be used as a target and to be made available in any opportunities we have to use land adjacent to our right-of-way that's not needed for real purposes is really an issue of policy. And we have a policy before us. We want to look at every site on a case-by-case basis when it comes to the Surplus Land Act. I mean, but you have never heard a statement ever that the act does not apply to us. Now, there is language in the recent amendments to make clear that special districts and joint powers authorities are subject to the Surplus Land Act. That was not clear in the past. But this has always been a law that we felt the spirit, you know, was applicable, and we have looked at it closely. There are issues as to whether leases are considered disposal, and I think that there is a lot of ambiguity in the law right now, still, as to whether leases are covered. And I know that we have had long conversations with the affordable community about the Hayward Park project, which we started in 2014 when the Surplus Land Act looked very different. But as you know, in that case, we have ended up with a 20% requirement, which I think this board felt comfortable moving forward with, and which at the time when it was approved 2 years ago was commendable. And, you know, is still, I think, a very good target for, you know, a transit agency. But again, that's a policy issue. And one that I think you need to chew on right now. But I'm happy to talk further about it. I mean, we do not take the position that this act does not apply to us, and you have never heard that statement from us. We have raised issues with the affordable community that I'd like to share with you that are complications. Most of the right-of-way we inherited from Caltrans, and Caltrans bought the right-of-way with federal funding. And when you have assets that are federally funded, you have to abide by the federal rules. And the federal government has its own rules. I know in your recent letter, Jonathan suggests that we said the federal rules override the Surplus Land Act. We have never said that. I did go back and look at our 2018 letter. What we said is it's a consideration to us because if in the eyes of the federal government we lose continuing control of land that we bought with federal money, we owe the federal government 75% of the fair market value. So there are considerations that may not apply to other public agencies but will in many instances apply to land, this little narrow strip of land that we have up and down the right-of-way and under which we are now considering what we can and should do with it, what's needed for rail, what may not be needed for rail in the future, and as to those opportunities, how best to use it to support our system and to support other policy goals the board may have.
And this, if I understand correctly, the Surplus Land Act only comes into play if we do something with the land, correct?
Correct.
So in other words, if we really wanted to make sure we weren't going to get sued, we could just build no housing, right?
You could do nothing.
Okay.
Right.
All right. I got that.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you. Questions and comments from the board? Director Brinkman?
Yes.
Thank you. My ears, of course, perked up when you started talking about the parking and the parking replacement parking. Somehow I've missed this in all of our discussions about the replacement parkings. Can you just walk me through what the math is for replacement parking at our sites? And if it's, to further on that question, if it's set in stone or if it's somewhat of a moving target based on use patterns of the station?
Yeah, let's go back and touch, connect all these dots for you, which I think is really important. So one of the things that we've talked about in the policy is having the right balance of access, right? Now, what that means, not in policy language, but in implementation language, is before we do any transit-oriented development project, one of the things that we're going to, well, the first thing that we're going to do now that we have RCUP, which we hopefully will have pretty soon, is we make sure it's consistent with RCUP, right? Before this, we would make sure it was consistent with the future vision of the railroad, which wasn't a policy. Now it is. So that's a great step. The very second thing we do after that is we do what you might call a mini access study on the site. So what we do is we look at our ridership model, we look at the property, and we look at the various modes of access that we have on site, and we project out what we're going to need in the future, right? In some instances, what we're hoping that we're going to see, and every station is going to be different for a variety of reasons, right? Caltrain tends to be unique because our stations aren't all made equal in terms of the stops they get, in terms of the population they're supposed to serve, and in terms of the frequency of service, right? So we'll do a little mini transit access study so that we set a program of the right amount of shuttle, the right amount of bus access, the right amount of bike access, the right amount of pedestrian access, and the right amount of parking, right? Now, all that's tied to an access hierarchy that this agency's looked at where we've tried to prioritize ped and bike access. But we do that study. And that study, on an individual basis, will make recommendations for us to set a program for how much of all that we need to have in any development. So what does that mean? We go to a parking lot. Hayward Park is an example. Hayward Park had 236 spots. We went looked at Hayward Park. We determined how many bus stops we were going to need there, how we were going to create ped access, how we were going to create bus access. We looked at all that. We put together a program. We made a recommendation that, hey, Hayward Park is probably a place we don't need to replace any parking because we've got people that go to other places. If we were to do a development at Redwood City, where we have more frequent service and we have a regional catchment area, we haven't done the work on this yet, but it's likely that number wouldn't be zero. It's likely that number would be somewhere, you know, significantly north of zero. So then we'd look at our site and we would say, okay, well, we need to get X number of bus stops in here. We need to get Y number of parking spots and all those things. We put together that program, and that helps us do an economic analysis of what we're going to look for in the development. It also gives us something to give to the development community that says, when you look to site plan this site, we expect to have this level of program of all these different modes of access on the site. So that's where that comes from. Now, the last dot I want to connect for you is what we talked about today, which is we have a site, and this site is worth X number of dollars, right? If it turns out that in developing that site, I now have to replace 10 parking spots, it's going to cost me dollars to replace those parking spots. They have to be built. They're also going to reduce the amount of development we have. So that program that we develop, right, turns into an encumbrance on the property that is an offset to the fair market value of that property as vacant or the revenue that we derive from our development. So I'll just give you an example. If you were talking to Bart right now, right, what Bart would tell you is that our portfolio hasn't derived that much revenue for us to date because we have chosen to take our revenue in the form of replacement parking. You go to Bart, they develop a site, they build a big replacement parking lot next to it. They've taken their revenue from TOD in the form of replacement parking. We're hoping that we create the right balance, but we do have to look at that on every site we do. We're not going to be able to say no parking everywhere, but we want to right size all that. So I hope that answers your question.
That does. Thank you. That makes it much more clear. Of course, as a 20-year-long car-free household, I always think the right amount of parking is no parking. But I totally see where this is coming from now. I guess I just want to make sure that two things as we go forward with that, that any replacement parking is built in such a way that it has the really quick and easy adaptive reuse component to it. As people stop driving to the stations, that we can take whatever space that parking is and turn it into something else, whether it's retail, whether it's more housing. And there are really clear things that are done when you're building parking that says, oh my God, this is going to be super difficult to do anything else with but park cars, or, oh wow, we can take this and turn it into something else. As it turns out that fewer and fewer people need to drive to that station. And the other thing that concerns me is, I think you had in there something like what the cost of that parking spot is. How do we make sure that that's paid by the user of that parking spot? I don't want to provide parking that's subsidized parking. And if we can take that into account when we say, yes, we're going to provide these 60 parking spots, but for people to use them, they're going to cost X per day. And if we build this parking that costs X per day, that's going to probably drive the demand of that parking down seriously. So I just want to make sure that we take those things into account as we start to look at the replacement parking. I think a lot of this development, like Hayward Park, can probably be built with a lot of this development. I know we don't have that many spots, can be car-free housing or less than one spot per unit, maybe 0.25 or 0.5 spots per unit. I just want to make sure that that's written into our policy somehow, or at least included in our thinking so that we don't preclude our ability to build car-free housing and preclude our ability to kind of go for as little replacement parking to zero as we can.
So I think you make some great points. Let me try to hit them quickly. Your point about adaptive reuse of parking is very important. I think it's important to note that when we talk about parking in a transit-oriented development, there are two types of parking in the broad sense. One is replacement parking that can be used for transit riders, and two is the required parking that can be used by the people in the development, right? And so it's important to create that distinction because on one hand, the local jurisdictions parking requirements for housing development are going to dictate how much parking per unit we create in the development. And in the peninsula, all the way up to San Francisco, where we end, there are a variety of levels of creativity, if you will, there. So we have to comply with that. Then the transit parking is parking that we look at as needed to supply access to our rails. Those are two different things. We try to be creative. We try to share that parking with it whenever possible. Not always possible, mostly for security issues. There are a lot of people who will talk about adaptive reuse of parking, which is a great idea. Oftentimes, parking on the peninsula ends up being underground because of height limitations, so the adaptive reuse is more difficult, right? So I would say that I like us to be encouraged to do all those things because we are on the same page. I want to be careful that we don't limit ourselves so that we're unable to be consistent with local policy and are unable to do anything, right? And then your final comment about parking cost and the cost of replacement parking feels like something that we should bring you when we talk about the economics of a transaction. I want to be a little bit careful because those things ride in two different areas. The development, you know, the parking that we need to do as a replacement comes in our TOD, and parking charges are addressed in our tariff and are usually done in a more comprehensive manner. So I think you're right that they should be talking to each other, but we also need to be careful that we're not overriding one with the other. But these are certainly things when we bring deals to the board we look at.
Thank you, and thank you for that really fulsome presentation. A couple things that I want to make sure when this comes to the full board is I really liked your attempt at that funky chart. And what I would like to see is really something that takes VTA and BART and us and just puts us side by side in terms of the total affordability, the type of affordability. And I thought you raised a really incredibly important point that I would actually put in the last section or last column, which is this idea about how affordability gets met. You raised a really excellent point. Do you want it site by site? Is it total package? Is it total housing over a certain amount of time? I think that is a really, really important question. And then the second thing that I wanted to ask is that you just embedded in that last part, which I thought was really important, which is setting expectations relative to what kind of goals we're setting over what period of time. That would be helpful. I think just would make it more clear for the board what we're trying to accomplish. Two things that I wanted to also recommend. I think it is really critical that we help all of our colleagues understand what resources are concretely available for housing. And the reason for that is what I found troubling about the $7 million deficit chart is that it's an illustrative chart, I know, but it gives an impression that may or may not be accurate based on the type of development you're looking at. I think what you were trying to demonstrate was there's this range of both opportunity and risk as we look at placing a premium on affordability, but absent being able to understand the range of risk versus there's this delta. And I know you gave us one kind of development. It was confusing to me, and I actually look at these quite often, and I couldn't say, oh, that totally makes sense. I know what you were trying to say to us, but
I think that's really important, just to be able to be more more concrete. And that's partly why I'm really interested in being able to demonstrate here all the sources of funds we have. And I think, Brian, one of the most important things you said that I thought was really something that is hard for us to understand all the ins and outs of yet is that there are these emerging pots of money also that I want to make sure we're keeping our eye on as an agency. Because when you do an RFQ or an RFP or however we do the partnership, I think there may be some preferences that you are going to have relative to what kinds of access to resources you're going to want that partner to have.
That's great advice. And maybe targeting our RFP to be more competitive in those ways is probably what you're ultimately getting.
Exactly. And then the other thing is, again, I know you've talked us through this, but I think just as you show this to the board, that when we're looking at investments, and this is something I've been giving quite a lot of thought about, is that we often, when I very first got into office, one of the things that I was sort of struck by is how often we look at rate of return over relatively short periods of time, like 5-10 years. But since we're in business, and you've pointed this out kind of over and over again, like for 100 years, that we're really looking at rate of return over a longer time frame. It'll be broken down into what we get sooner, what we get long term. Does the property get conveyed to us? All smart things, Brian, that you already do. But I also thought it might be important for the board to understand concretely that when we're measuring apples to apples, what's the rate of return that we're measuring if we were to do, you know, depending on the type of affordability that you'd be looking at. And so if our objective is to look at rates of return for projects starting with the time that the property becomes unavailable to us, because that's a loss, you know, if we were using it for parking or anything else over a 10-year period of time and then over a 20-year period of time. Again, because I just think future boards are going to need to be able to put that into the context of how we're using these opportunities to raise revenue. I think that will become particularly important much longer term when we're expanding not just air rights, but again, when we're needing on some occasions to buy property because we're going to be building out, or instead of renting lay down space, when you're buying lay down space, like, do I want the lay down space here? Because there's both going to be a housing opportunity as well as a proximity opportunity. Anyway, I think it'll just help the board understand when we make investments, because the other opportunity here is really going to be, as we're doing other kinds of developments, is doing what you already do, which is be opportunistic and smart, which is, you know, you've demonstrated that to me a number of times. But again, I just think it would be important for the board.
Rate of return over time. Understood.
Yeah. And then the last thing, I just wanted to make, I wanted to just touch on something. Cheryl, you're so smart to think about, you know, reuse. And that's, it's really hard to put that into context. But what it got me thinking a lot about is, as it relates to minimum standards for parking. A lot of the cities that we're working with, one question I have is whether or not we need to proactively be moving policies that parking proximate to transit has a certain, that we're looking at a rate, I'm sorry, housing relative to transit has a different ratio of parking. The restrictions that I've seen that have been most striking to me are actually from banks. So that the banks have intervened when, like, the cities have been more bold and BART's been more bold with the banks saying, whoa, you really only want less than 0.09 spaces per unit. So I think that's worth actually thinking about. And again, I know, Jim, you talk to your colleagues all the time. I think it would be interesting to understand whether or not there's some collective action that we need to think about taking with legislation to protect our flexibility around parking based on our actual need. And based on the housing's actual need, especially if it's right on top of a, you know, a train station. And then coupled with, again, there are some banks, Brian, and I know you know this, that are much more forward-thinking about what their expectation is for parking for new developments. And so, again, I think when we do RFQs and RFPs, like talking to those banking partners that are used to investing in affordable housing, and I don't want to be a commercial for banks, but there are some that are really good and some no bueno on that particular topic. So anyway, that, but it got, but just one last thing. on this. I was thinking about when you said, yeah, we're not going to need parking anymore. And it got me thinking about all of the interest in these automated vehicles that are going to be able to take people to and from where they're going. And it's not so George Jetson, right? Like, we can see that coming. But it did make me think a lot about the point that you raised about how much room do you need to have for ingress and egress of other kinds of automobiles or automation relative to that, to these stations. And I don't know how you protect a box there, but I would be interested in, as you're thinking about this in the future, I'm interested in how we do plan for that and what is our opportunity for planning for that. So, for example, I've seen those buses that can pull up and be charged while they're waiting to pick people up. And, you know, is that something that we would have right attached to the stations or kind of general charging, you know, that's wearing your Samtrans hat? Like, how is that going to align? And I didn't mean to take us down crazy lane, but when you were talking about that, I was like, wow, that is so fascinating. You're totally right. Like, what is that really going to be?
How do we plan for something that we don't know what it looks like?
Right, right, right. So thank you. I'm sorry that was a lot, but if that information could be present, I think it would help all of us.
Yeah, I mean, that's all, you know, very important stuff. And I think thinking seriously about the access plan for every station in the simplest possible way, that's the simplest possible way to say that. There's a lot of layers of creativity we put on top of that. But making sure that each station has the right amount and the right balance of access there, knowing that the very reason we're doing TOD is to give us a higher balance walk and bike.
Right.
So that's the simple way to put it. And then those other layers come into sort of the art of the practice, if you will, in my view.
Good point. Thank you.
Those are all excellent points. I've got a few things. First of all, can you talk a little bit about the right of first refusal idea? Congresswoman Speer reached out to a number of us and proposed that and the idea of workforce housing. Can you talk about the pros, cons, and pragmatic problems that might arise with a right of first refusal approach?
So, you know,
and maybe explain to everyone what I mean by right of first refusal.
Yeah, I mean, well, let me see if I've got you right on what that is. I mean, I think
the idea is that nonprofits or any nonprofit, not-for-profit, nonprofit, whatever type of organization it was that specialized in 100% affordable developments would have a right of first refusal for any parcel we were going to use for housing.
So, you know, I think that in some of these instances, one of the things that we're trying to do here is build a policy, again, that gives us flexibility because of our uniqueness. And one of the things that the reason that staff has been pushing, and we've been pushing for, you know, 10 years to try to do RCUP, to get some policy level decisions about really what it is we have to play with in the development world. And the reason we've been pushing for that is, and I say this ad nauseum, and I apologize for saying it again, but we've always known that we've got unique properties. We're different than other people. And my favorite picture of the Millbrae BART station and the Caltrain BART station, which I don't have with me today, but, you know, the Millbrae BART station is this gigantic box, and then we're this little rectangle. It shows that we have to think, as Director Chavez likes to say, a little bit more creatively and be a little bit better. It also means that when it comes to a policy, one size fits all is very difficult for us to do. And the simple answer there, and I'm going to get where you want to go, but I want to give this context. I think it's vitally important. The simple answer there is, I think everybody would say we always want to lease property rather than sell property. But then we find that we've got a site that's 15,000 square feet. We're probably never going to find anybody who's want to do a ground lease on that. So we need to be flexible in our policy. Now extrapolate that out to your question, right? When we're looking at property, two of the things that we've seen in there that's unique about our property, besides the size, is the configuration of our property. Some of the property that we have is property that's only available for development by the next door owner. You know, we have stuff that, if you imagine a street and then a railroad, and then we own the back of the property, if you will, that comes off that street. There's really only one or two people that could ever do a development deal with us in that end. So we don't want to have a policy that is limiting us in what we can do with those sites, because there may be some real benefits and catalysts to bringing development to the area or more development to the area because our site can be linked to that. We may not have the opportunity to give anybody a right of first refusal because the property is not independently developable. So that's one of the issues. The other concern that we've had is, again, on a broad sense, until we look at our sites and we understand the characteristics of our sites, there may be some constituent materials in those sites that may limit what we could do. And again, we wouldn't want to say, hey, we've got a policy that says we have to do A, B, and C, and then we go out and we turn out, well, we can't do half those things, and so we put ourselves in a little bit of a box. So those are sort of the concerns there. And then the other concern that I've got ties to what I feel are some policy considerations this board maybe needs to think about a little bit, which is, you know, we've talked about partnering with cities and we've talked about complete communities. And we want to be in a position where we can be aggressive and try to get the cities to do the right things with regard to height and density and those other things. On the other hand, we want to be careful that if a city is saying, you know, we have a plan and we want X, Y, and Z uses here and we want A, B, and C uses over there, you know, we want to be very careful not to come in and say, well, we want you to flip your whole plan around to accommodate us. We want to try to work with the community to try to create some completeness. So I think for those three reasons, we would like the policy to be flexible, which doesn't mean that the practice can't be tailored to each individual parcel, but that's why we're kind of recommending some flexibility in that respect.
There are parcels we've identified as suitable for housing, right?
Correct.
Is there anything stopping us from having a policy of a right of a first refusal for organizations to do 100% housing just tailored to those parcels? Because if I understood you correctly, I'm not sure that what you said would apply necessarily. Those concerns would apply to those parcels.
So the answer to your question on that end is, assuming that there were sites that we looked at that didn't have any of these outside constraints, and this policy board wanted to make a statement that said that's what we should do, there's nothing that would limit it. I would just warn that we don't put ourselves in a one-size-fits-all box so that things, you know, that we can't do things because we've limited ourselves in our policy.
Okay. Food for thought. I appreciate it. Okay. So I'm also, I have the advantage of having recent perspective of having tinkered with land use policies writ large in Belmont. And we did a specific plan to unlock density in the transit corridor area. And I think we did a pretty good job, but 2 years out, 3 years out, I also see where we could have done better and what we missed. And so one of the things I think we might have done a better job on was brought up by one of the speakers, which is height minimums. Now, I recognize that there's an inherent tension between what we might want and what a city allows, but I want to be very careful because there's specific projects that are coming through. But I'll simply say that I've now become aware that, you know, just because you say you can go four or five stories doesn't mean everyone's going to build four or five stories of housing. You may well end up with someone who comes through and says, I'd like to do townhomes half a block away from your Caltrain station. So I'm very interested in the notion of height minimums, extraordinarily interested in them. I say that full well knowing that, you know, if we say it's a four-story height minimum and a city has a three-story height maximum, we've got a problem. I still think we should have height minimums. I'll leave that to my colleagues to weigh on, and if they want, and we could also, I'm sure it'll come up at the full board, but I think that's something we should really seriously consider as we move forward with this. You know, there's also, speaking of tensions, there's a tension between not subsidizing parking and discouraging folks from using the train system, because there's folks who simply will not get to the Caltrain any other way than ride in their car. You know, I've had several anecdotal pieces of emails thrown at me when we started charging for parking at the Belmont station. People said, why the hell would I use the station anymore? I'll just go to Hillsdale. And some of them said, now that I have to pay, I'm not going to take the train anymore. I don't, that's anecdote. Anecdote is a hell of a drug and we should limit how much of it we take. But, you know, those folks are out there. So it's something to consider. And there's a tension between maximizing revenue and helping with the affordable housing crisis. But am I serious, to answer a question, about trying to help with the affordable housing crisis? Absolutely. Because there seems to be a misconception often that conflates the notion that government should be careful with taxpayer money and wise with it, and the notion that government is a business that should maximize revenue. It's not. It just isn't. Full stop. That's not what we do here. It's not what we do in any agency. And so that tension is going to come up continually. With all of that said, before I go any farther, I want to thank you. I know this has been an incredible slog. You were accused of some things along the way by the activist community, which were unfair and unfounded.
I was going to say, what did I say?
My bad.
I don't know what you said, but I probably wrote it down.
you know, this is hard stuff. I mean, this is the stuff that gets me excited because it's really kind of wonky and policy-oriented and really in the weeds. But this is tough stuff, especially when you got a board as activist as our board is and with as many different viewpoints to distill this down into something that you think might actually thread the needle. It's to be lauded. Really good job.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Now, with that context.
Mr. Chair, may I add one more concept that I think makes this really the subject really hard?
Sure.
And that is the constitutional prohibition against gift of public funds. Mm-hmm. And I offer that up because I struggle with that. It's one of the issues keeping me up at night, because you look at the SLA, which is a statute enacted by our state legislature, which tries to say that if property is transferred pursuant to that act, it isn't a gift of public funds. But I learned from law school that a statute can't override the Constitution, and the gift of public funds is a concept embedded in the California Constitution. So I just it is hard stuff. This is all hard stuff. We have crises. We have crises in housing, and we have crises in transportation, and we have crises that we don't have public resources sufficient to address them, these crises. So lots of crises.
I hear you. And I'm not overly concerned with that. I'd love to explore that more with you. But if a gift of constitution, if the constitutional prohibition against a gift of public funds could serve to block 100% affordable developments, we wouldn't have them in cities up and down the peninsula. So I'm confident there's a way to get around that, and that we're not going to get sued by anyone for that. But I hadn't thought of that, so I appreciate you pointing out.
I think that an agency like the Joint Powers Board is a little different than cities and counties, because the state there is authority from the California State Supreme Court, which makes very clear that it's a gift of public funds unless the transfer is made in furtherance of the particular purpose of the agency. And the reason I know that is that's a case that came out of the Golden Gate Bridge District that we represent many years ago. So, you know, cities and counties have very broad police powers and authorities. I would say less so in the case of the Joint Powers Board, where our mission is to provide commuter rail transportation. So it's just a concept to keep in mind when we talk about rights of first refusal and how we would institute those. I think that, you know, what's fair market value, there's probably, you know, lots of experts who would take a piece of property and give you different values that they consider fair market value. So there's probably not one value, but at some point there could be an issue as to whether these are resources that are arguably being given away for a purpose that does not coincide or align with our particular mission.
Yeah. Not my area of law, but I'd be more than comfortable making the argument that building housing next to transit creates transit riders, which is in furtherance of our mission. So hopefully we never have to deal with it in anything other than the esoteric, though. Thank you for that, though. I hadn't thought of that. So with all of that said, in my perfect world, this policy would have come back a lot different. It would have had 100% affordable requirement. with 50% targeted to very low and 50% to low. But I recognize that my ideal world isn't the real world, and that it just doesn't make sense to do that, nor do I think that would ever pass at a board level. That said, I think we can do better than 20%. And my proposal would be that we go to 30% with 15% very low and 15% low. And that would make me a lot more comfortable. So I'm curious to hear what the board thinks about that. Or I'm sorry, the committee. This is not the board.
So just to make sure I understand, so you're saying very low and low meaning BLI?
Right now what they have is at least 10% of the units targeted to very low income households, which is no more than 50% of AMI, and then the remainder of units that make up the 20%, which I'm not good at math, but I think is 10. I'm not. That's why I went into law. Would be low income, which is no more than 80% of AMI. And, you know, there's a couple of things I've toyed with, and this, again, goes to having had recent experience with this and looking back and saying, oh, why didn't I think of that? I'm open to that, and I'm also open to 10 very low, 10 low, and 10 moderate, because one of the things we did in Belmont is we said 15% low, and I felt so proud of that because at the time a lot of people weren't doing that. But then somebody actually at one point proposed a project that would have had some teacher housing in it, and the beginning salary, I think, was lower than low, and we couldn't have done it without tinkering with our rules again. And so it reminded me of the need for flexibility and to capture different income groups. You know, it's not the worst thing in the world to do that. So I'm open to either of those ideas.
So part of the reason I was interested in seeing the chart with all the different, you know, where we were, even our different cities and properties, is that I was very interested in seeing whether or not we were on BART for some reason. I mean, BART, VTA, for some reason, I have a 35% number in my head. I think the point that Brian raised about how we get to those goals, like VTA had built in some flexibility that allows for, among a number of properties, having, you know, one single affordable project or housing development. And so my goal would be to be as high as possible too. And that's the other reason I was really interested in what the funding sources were, because I'll just use in our community right now, with Measure A, our housing bond, we have $700 million of it is set aside for permanent supportive housing. So it's really intended to get the chronically homeless off the street. And then we have another $100 million that is for that low-income community. And then we also set aside $100 million that has a lot more flexibility in it that could be for up to 120% of AMI. But the idea behind that money is entirely to help invest in proximity housing close to transit or close to a major job center. And, you know, we're really trying to work with people on that. And we have some money that is set aside for first-time home buyer that I think what we're going to end up doing is trying to work with VTA to use a piece of VTA's property long-term to build opportunities for housing for public sector or nonprofit employees so that they can stay close to where they work. So I concur with you. I'd like it to be higher. I also like the flexibility. I also think as we look at the Dearden Station area that playing a leadership role in making sure that the housing there is diverse is actually really important, because otherwise we're gonna wipe people out. We have just parenthetically, we have a middle school right next to the county building that last year, I forgot what their total population is, but last year they lost 90 students to families that couldn't afford to live here. And the area that they're living in is had always been relatively moderate to low income, gone. And I forgot what the portion of it is, but we anticipate that half of those parents are still working here, but their kids are, and their families, you know, they live in San Joaquin or Manteca or Modesto or whatever, and they're driving, I'm sure not electric vehicles, to San Jose. So it's complicated, and so you're right. Flexibility is actually a really important, you know, being able to balance flexibility with setting a goal, and that's why I was so interested in what you were talking about, because you wanted to not set expectations, and I'm trying to figure out how to set expectations, but to create more flexibility so that you can.
do what it is you do, Brian, because I know what you're good at is negotiating. So, no, you have to be. Otherwise, I'd be very annoying to you. Trust me. So, anyway, I like the idea of going higher and then having a conversation about how we build in the flexibility for the staff to get the job done, and especially where we have resources, where you know where we can invest, where we have other partners who will invest.
Dr. Brinkman.
I just want to hug both of you for your dedication to this subject because it's so important. So, yes, I absolutely agree with you. I do want us to be role models. I want us to be leaders in what we do with the property we have available. But looking at it through the lens of a bicycle pedestrian advocate, I don't want the perfect to destroy the good. So as long as we keep that flexibility, because I see that a little too much sometimes in San Francisco where we just give up, we throw up our hands because we can't get the two sides to come together. So I absolutely support us doing everything that we can to make sure the properties that we partner in developing are as affordable as possible. But I want to make sure that we manage to build something. So,
and I think that was the point Brian was raising.
Would you both be comfortable recommending to the larger board that the minimum be 30% and that we would like to have a conversation with the board about mm-hmm. what percentage should be very low, and if any should be moderate as well?
I'm happy to support that.
Capture that?
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see what we'll see what we do.
All right. That's all the comments I have, believe it or not.
I told him he's making me look like a conservative. Very few people do that to me, by the way, in my world.
I know. I hear you. It's great, isn't it?
It's like, what, Cindy?
So with that, I would entertain a motion.
Oh, motion to approve with the recommendation.
And also, if I could, I'll second it and just request the other information I requested from staff, just because I think if the board has it all, they'll be much better able to understand what it is we're trying to get done.
And implicit in that is that we'll have a discussion about height limits, too?
Oh, I'm a... Yes.
Awesome.
That's just crazy to me that... Oh, we have some parts of San Jose that are like that, too, and I just remember thinking, what?
Why didn't I do a minimum?
Yeah, like, what? Yeah.
Yeah.
So...
All right. Well, there's been a motion and a second then?
Yes.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed or abstaining? The motion carries.
And thank you for the staff work. Very, very
good. Thank you.
Seriously. Really incredible work.
Yeah, very incredible work.
And important stuff. Next up, we have item number 8, the Caltrain Business Plan update.
Didn't that get done? I'm just kidding. Sebastian's like...
good afternoon. Sebastian Petty, Deputy Chief of Caltrain Planning. Given where we are on the... I guess I wanted to start off by doing a little bit of a time check. There's a lot of slides here. I don't intend to go through them all, but I want to sort of calibrate exactly what I'm targeting here.
Can you set the timer? No, I'm just kidding.
I will try to be fairly...
I'm fine.
I'm hearing 5:30 is a hard stop,
okay.
And she's okay, and I would prefer 5:15, so...
Okay. So let me start then by just kind of introducing what's being presented at WIPLEP, how that relates to what may come to the board at various points, and what will come back here. Since this venue has been set up during the past year, as we were working through the business plan, we would generally provide monthly updates to an ad hoc committee as well as to some of our other standing groups like the city staff working group and the local policymakers group. Now that we have this venue here, those same kinds of updates will come here. In general, they would then proceed on to the board in a written format in consent and then be periodically punctuated with a shorter sort of verbal presentation that I might provide. This won't go on for too much longer. We are nearing the end of the business plan, but there are still some major pieces of work to get through, some of which I'll talk about and highlight here. So this is really, I think, kind of something we're talking about for the next few months. This particular presentation is one that would go just in a written format to the full board as an information item. And then what we're looking at is coming back in the following month, so at the March board meeting, with a sort of consolidated, more substantive set of information that I would run through in a brief presentation. But the WIPLEP would get the longer version of both months. So I will go through this quickly. And the other thing I'd note is that there's a lot of technical material in this presentation. A lot of it has been moved into an appendix. So it's there, it's in the public record. And certainly if folks here have particular questions about it, we can refer to it, but I won't exhaust you by going through it extensively. I do want to provide a brief overview of where we are in the business plan process and kind of what it's going to take to get us to the end. Then talk, the major content in this presentation is really focused on train service and what Caltrain service could look like in the more near term, so not out in 2040, but really in the next decade. And then I'll touch briefly on the other work that's going on and what will come to this committee soon. So I'm gonna run through these slides quickly because I know that this group is very familiar with the overall arc of the business plan. What I will point out on the timeline is that the board took a major step of adopting the service vision in fall. We had our organizational workshop and some of the work that was associated with that sort of in the late fall into kind of the holiday season. And where we are right now is really trying to finish out the business plan with the hope that in the spring, at some point in the spring, we'll be coming back to the board with a full set of actual documents for adoption that would include the service vision that you previously adopted and content around that, supporting technical material, as well as an implementation plan that really says, if that's the big vision, what do we need to be focused on in the next few years and moving forward? There are two big parts to that. The first is what I call making it happen, which is really the implementation plan. And I'm using the idea of an implementation plan pretty expansively here. It's calibrating from a giant regional vision in 2040 to really say what might the next decade of Caltrain look like. That includes looking at what the service could look like over the next decade. What can we do with the electrification system that we're building now? What might the next incremental investment look like? And that's a lot of what this presentation is about. That'll be paired up with detailed financial projections that include funding and revenue analysis. And so that'll really frame what are we looking at financially in the next 10 years, building on some of the work that Derek's group has done, what's possible in terms of funding and revenue, and potentially what's the gap that we're looking at where new revenue may really be needed. The other piece of implementation work that we'll be doing is really a program for the next 2 to 3 years that looks at follow-on studies and policy actions that will be needed to kind of keep carrying forward the work towards the overall service vision and the work of the business plan. The other piece of technical work that's not really represented in this deck but will be coming to this group and the board and incorporated is the work to round out the vision. And this is related to a lot of comments that we received and work that we've intended to do all along, and that includes looking at how our system connects to other systems and what first and last mile and station access might look like for us. It includes an equity analysis and a focus on what sort of policy options and interventions are available to Caltrain to potentially make the system more accessible to everyone in our corridor and our community. And so that work is well underway and will be coming here soon. And then a big picture funding analysis. So there really are two pieces of funding analysis. There's a 10-year, which is very focused. It looks really year to year. This is what we think the costs are. These are the revenue options that could be realistic. So really kind of focus tables, those are funding plans. We'll also do an overall funding strategy, which is more of the $20, $40, $25 billion price tag. What are the broader strategies and choices we could get there? So we won't try to project, you know, exactly what the makeup of revenue coming into the agency might be in 2037, but we will talk at a macro level around kind of funding strategies to sort of set an overall policy approach and concept going forward. So that said, the focus of this presentation is really about the service and what Caltrain's service may look like in the next 10 years. And so what I'm showing up here is the 2040 service vision, the illustrative service detail that accompanied the policy statement the board adopted. So going up to 12 or more trains per hour per direction, four of them being high-speed rail and express local service, really all day, both way electrified service, all the way from Gilroy, all the way up to downtown San Francisco. And that service comes associated with this giant regional price tag where we're wrapping in grade separations, we're looking at major terminal projects, we're looking at electrifying to Gilroy, a massive expansion of the fleet. And so a very high price tag, $23 billion in new investment, and a real substantial jump in operating costs too. One of the things that was probably less apparent in that work that we did is that work wasn't all about 2040. It really built on a series of conceptual investments in time. And so we worked with our partners and took their assumptions about when projects would get built and looked at how they all layered together. And so I'll belabor this point a little bit because it's important. We started with what we have on the ground today in 2018, and then we looked at, okay, we know what we're building and buying for electrification in 2022. And then we did this exercise to look at what other plans or milestones were in place. So a major change for this corridor will be the point at which high-speed rail shows up. Their planning documents say 2029, and so that's what we included as an assumption. We also looked out to 2033 when they're slated to run their sort of full complement of trains. We also looked at 2029 as being the nominal year when DTX would open. That's the public date that San Francisco has put out there. And so those major investments on the corridor really structure what we assume happens over time. And so all of the projections we made were based around that framework of dates. Now that we've decided where we want to get in 2040, one of the things we have the opportunity to do as we think about how we implement the plan is think about, are there some of the investments we assumed happened at the end after 2033 that maybe could happen a little bit earlier if we had the funding? Is there a way to start delivering some of the benefits of 2040, of all those things we want to achieve in 2040 earlier than we assumed? And so the idea is that now that we know where we want to go, we can start thinking about different paths to get there that are still compatible with that long-range vision, still get everyone where they need to go, but maybe help us get there a little quicker. So some of the key questions that we looked at in detail in this deck for the next decade are really... how can we use, really, one of the questions is, what is the real market demand that we see out there for rail service over the next 10 years? So we've looked at kind of the very long range based on regional projections. Now we've taken a closer look, really looking at what's actually on the ground or in the pipeline up and down the Caltrain corridor. And then how can we best use the system we're building and buying for electrification to serve that demand? What are some options for that? How can we also deliver some of those benefits of the 2040 service vision early? And then what comes next? If we have the opportunity or the funding to make another investment in Caltrain, an incremental investment towards that 2040 service vision, what would that look like? What are some options available to us? So this is where I'm going to start running through the slides faster and saying more of what they say rather than going through them. But we basically have several sections in here. The first focus is on really CalMod service in the 2020s. So that's the what can we do with the electrification part. We went through a market analysis where we talk about the demand that's in the corridor and that we think is really going to likely manifest over the next 10 years. I think key points there on the summary slide is that we believe there's a lot of latent demand. There are people who would ride Caltrain today if the service were more frequent or ran longer hours. There is a lot of very real-looking population and employment growth. This is not regional projections. It's things that are under construction now or in the pipeline. And there are some major connecting services that will increase access to the system, a big one being the Central Subway up in San Francisco. So I'll move through these quickly, but we looked again, scanned the whole corridor, went through really what's been approved by individual cities, what's in the pipeline. I think the punchline is that there's a lot of growth that's pretty close to being real, and it's highly concentrated around the Caltrain corridor. If you look up and down the three counties, a lot of that growth, particularly the major projects, are within the general catchment area of the Caltrain system. When you look at that in terms of totals, you can kind of see the density map of where things are. There definitely are some hot spots on the corridor, but there's a lot of growth happening all over. That growth does extend further south than we're able to robustly serve at this point. So we know that there are some near-term limitations on our ability to provide, you know, massively increased service to South County. There's a lot of growth, particularly all the way through San Jose, more limited growth down in Morgan Hill and Gilroy, but we did want to include that in the market assessment as well. What we project that this will mean for a lot of our stations is going from a situation where we have today, where there really are maybe eight or nine stations that are kind of at the high end of ridership station, producing stations in density, and then a whole bunch of stations that are more in the lower range, to a future where things really shift around and we start to have an increasingly large number of high and moderate ridership stations. It also means that we think we're going to be dealing with crowding on the trains for the foreseeable future. Electrification is going to provide a lot more capacity, but we're kind of playing catch up here, and the growth is happening faster. The next thing we looked at was just what are our priorities for how we use the electrified system. Overall electrification is a massive transformational benefit to the Caltrain system. But it's not a $25 billion project, so it can't do everything in the service vision. So there are some trade-offs we have to consider. One big one is the extent to which we increase frequency at more stations versus prioritize reducing travel time between our biggest stations. Another one is the extent to which we kind of continue to operate a pretty customized service, where each train is somewhat different, has a number of different stopping patterns versus move towards a very standardized schedule. And then the last one is how much we focus on having differentiated service, so express or local trains that, are maybe serving particular markets versus trying to just maximize the overall capacity. And I won't go through these in detail because I'm sensitive to folks' time, but... generally what I can say we landed on in terms of what we looked at was, we did tilt more towards emphasizing increasing frequency at more stations. I think that's what the ridership analysis shows is needed. It's also what we heard consistently from cities up and down the corridor, is that they wanted more stops at stations. And the ridership demand is clearly there. We have definitely prioritized looking at a more standardized schedule than what we operate today. So looking at schedules that are symmetrical in the north and southbound directions, trying to have ones where it's a relatively simple number of patterns that repeat per hour and not having different patterns in different hours. And then we did a range of work to look at some service patterns that were more mixed. So having really express and local train or express and limited trains, and then some that have, just skip-stop trains throughout the hour, more standardized or more consistent service between the trains. We evaluated a number of different options, and we looked at things like service metrics and how those impact passengers. We looked at capacity and crowding, user experience. And to kind of cut to the punchline, we basically landed on two options that we think are good service patterns for the electrified system. One is, so this is at 6 trains per hour for the peak hour direction. One would be 2 zone trains, or essentially 4 zone express trains per hour. So you would have 2 trains that run a local service in the north of the corridor and express in the south, 2 trains that run a local service in the south of the corridor and express in the north, and then 2 express trains similar to the Baby Bullet. So you're covering all of your markets that way. And then another potential recommendation, which would be a purely distributed skip-stop schedule. An issue that I think is of interest to a lot of cities up and down the corridor is the number of stops per station. So we did look at that. Generally, what you can see on the graph there is sort of the corridor-wide aggregate increase in frequency at stations. So overall, on a corridor-wide basis, we're massively increasing frequencies at a lot of stations up and down the corridor. It's important to emphasize, and I will be presenting this to the local policymaker group in more length and in more detail, that these are still illustrative schedules. We're sort of narrowing down the field and really thinking about some of the key policy factors and coming up with a couple good examples to look at. As we get closer to really running the full service, we will go through a full-scale planning process to kind of pick the exact schedule we'll run, and we'll look at things like updated market demand and ridership patterns, approved station area growth, station access and connectivity in more detail, social equity and geographic equality, and also things like transportation demand management policies. And those are the combination of factors that might really tip a station from getting 2 trains per hour to the 4 train category. And so that's work that'll come. But again, what we're doing now is taking work that was done in the EIR for electrification a while ago, kind of updating it, putting some policy factors around it. So we're starting to think about it and kind of narrowing the field down to a couple of pretty, what we think are pretty good concepts. And so that we can then take that final step. These are illustrative service levels that we assumed at stations throughout the corridor. There are a couple of, generally what you're seeing in red is where the stations are increasing. The gray that's harder to see right now would be the existing service levels, and they're different for some stations in a northbound and southbound direction versus in the future. We're recommending that they would be uniform in both directions. Generally, you're seeing service increasing significantly at many stations throughout the corridor. There are a few stations that don't change. There are a few stations where there would be potentially a slight service reduction, and I recognize that's a hard pill to swallow. Those are generally in stations where they receive different numbers of trains in the north or the southbound direction today, and because of ridership patterns and surrounding land uses, the recommendation is they might go down to the lower level. Again, these are illustrative, but
quick question.
Yes.
How much housing does Belmont have to build to spike that that line there? I'm just kidding, it's rhetorical.
So here's the detail on the two illustrative service plans that we came up with. There's more discussion of how those would work with Gilroy service, which at this point would be provided by a limited number of diesel trains that would sort of slot into these schedules and through run from Gilroy. So, for example, on the first one, if you were getting on the train in Gilroy or south of Tamian, you would get on a diesel train that would become the express train. In the case of a distributed skip stop schedule, it's a little bit harder, but one of the skip stops, in this case the one on the bottom, would be the train pattern that would go all the way down to Gilroy for the trips that are making the trip down there today. In the off-peak, we are making a general recommendation that, funding permitting, we should be increasing off-peak service. And we think there's a lot of evidence. There's some slides in the appendix that to support there's really robust market demand for that. Generally, we think we should be providing enough peak off-peak service to have some kind of an express train as well as something that's providing the local coverage. That could be up to 15-minute service off-peak during the midday, potentially less at other times. I think the big caveats around that we will have to really look at as we get closer to implementation are the cost of providing that service as well as our ability to accommodate construction projects on the corridor. I'm sorry, aware of the time, so I want to move on to the next section because I think it's important and of interest to folks. So that provided some framework around what a 6-train-per-hour service could look like in the 2020s. And then the question really is, we know from the ridership projections that by the time we are getting into the late 2020s, the trains are probably going to start being pretty full again. And we certainly know that if San Francisco and partners like Caltrain and High Speed Rail are successful in getting DTX open, the trains are going to really be full, because that project suggests that just providing that direct access to the core of downtown San Francisco will create a huge spike in ridership. And so the question, I think, for Caltrain is, well, what would we do next? If we wanted to be able to provide some more service or some more capacity, what could that look like? And again, that gets to the question of, are there different paths that get us to 2040 that are still consistent with that long-range vision but might allow Caltrain to increase its service a little earlier? There are a few different things we could look at. One of the obvious ones would be lengthening trains. There are some challenges to lengthening trains in the Caltrain system beyond 7-car trains. One of them is the configuration of the existing maintenance facility. The other one is generally platform length at stations, but the maintenance facility is a big one. We think that there's a pretty serious challenge when we move from 7-car EMUs to 8-car EMUs with how the facility is designed. It's something we'll be doing further analysis on subsequently to really make sure that we understand the details of it. But what we focused on here is the question of what would it look like if Caltrain wanted to operate 8 trains an hour in the peak sooner rather than later. To emphasize that, this is not the full-blown service vision. Again, this is not a $25 billion project we're talking about. It's an incremental step. So there are some things that we definitely couldn't do without spending the full amount of money. we would not be able to operate a pure express and local service without building some of the overtakes we've talked about. So that would remain a longer term goal. We would not, at this point, we would not be operating 10 car train lengths. We're talking about shorter trains. This is assuming a universe where we're pre-DTX, so the service isn't going into the core of downtown San Francisco. Similarly, we're assuming that this is pre-electrification to Gilroy and pre-full build-out of Diridon. And so service south of Tamian would remain more limited. Within more or less the railway that we have now and are building in the future, it is possible for Caltrain to operate 8 trains once we are electrified. We can do it within the existing signal system. It does limit our options in terms of what we can do, but once we're able to fully electrify the mainline fleet, there are options to operate an 8-train-per-hour service. It would require us to be fully electrified on the main line, which would mean this would be the point at which we would have to convert to a shuttle service for passengers south of Tamian. So we would no longer be able to operate a diesel service from Gilroy up through the main line. It would have to be a coordinated transfer at Diridon. In terms of increasing service at stations, the increase starts to look pretty dramatic. So there you can see the existing sort of service levels by station to what could be achieved with the 6-train-per-hour plan to what would be achieved with the 8-train-per-hour plan. And so at this point, most stations on the main line are getting 15-minute service in each direction during the peak. Many stations on the main line are getting 8 trains per hour. And again, you can see what the sort of the illustrative service levels would look like there. So a real huge step change in the level of service to stations. In terms of what this would take from an investment standpoint, and we'll be coming back with full financial projections around what this would look like, but it's important to note this presumes that we're continuing to work on all of the things that are in the long-range vision. So continuing to work on grade separations, continuing to work on programmatic station improvements throughout the system, and certainly continuing to work on the major investments. So the downtown extension in Penn Avenue, the Diridon Station project, continuing to work with High Speed Rail on the implementation of the blended system. So I think it's important to start off with emphasizing none of that stops. That's all going on. But in terms of what specific incremental investments and changes would be needed to move from 6 trains to 8 trains, in terms of the larger dollar items, we would need an expanded EMU fleet, so we would need more trains to run this. We would need more train storage. We do generally think there's a way to make it work within the existing maintenance facility, but we would need more storage for trains. We would need to eliminate the holdout rules for regularly served stations. So those are a couple of stations we still have that have substandard platform configurations that affect the overall operations of the system. Right now, the regularly served ones are Broadway and Atherton. So those stations would need to be removed from regular weekday service or rebuilt. And we do think we would need level boarding. This is something that's been part of our long-range plans, and to achieve this level of service on the corridor to keep overall dwell time short and achieve the level of reliability needed to operate this, we do think that would be one of the major investments required. Again, doing this would require shifting to a Gilroy shuttle service. As part of that, we would assume that we would strive to go up to the maximum number of allowed trips on that shuttle service and look at the ability to have as much service down there as possible combined with a coordinated transfer. But it is a real limitation until we electrify down there or build through the Diridon project. There are some real limits. And then there would be some minor track work in the vicinity of Diridon required. Generally, we did a lot of work around this. This works with the existing configuration of Diridon and the use of the tenants there. But there would need to be some minor track work to make it fully functional. We are coming back with next month with sort of a full set of financials around this, looking at costs and the relative difference in the operating costs and ridership associated with this. In general, the order of magnitude of the investments we're talking about in terms of making the 8 trains happen is more than $1 billion, less than $2 billion. I want to provide some characterization of that.
That's awesome.
Knowing that I am going to come back with more precise numbers, but relative to a $25 billion price tag, just to kind of calibrate the scale of investment we're describing. We have done updated ridership forecasts on our land use projections and both of these service patterns. We've also kind of scaled the ridership forecast so that that we don't assume that every new rider shows up the day we run an electrified train, but rather that it builds up over a series of years as kind of new services are implemented. And so generally, we think that the initial electrification will add about 21,000 new riders to our system. And we've assumed that that'll take probably several years for that ridership to build up. We think that increasing to an 8-train service could add another 20,000 riders based on our projections. And again, this is pre-DTX. DTX would probably add another 20 to 30 on top of that.
Which means that Director Stone can say to his constituents who say they won't pay to park, they won't ride anymore,
yeah,
smile and nod while thinking, smell you later. What are you going to do? Sit on 101 in your car?
Yeah, you can't compete with this.
So I'll maybe skip the next steps and work on, because I realize it is getting quite late.
It is. Yeah. Director Chavez has a hard stop in 8 minutes, and we have at least one comment card, which will count for 3 minutes. So are we good? That was incredibly thorough.
It was thorough, and it's a fantastic presentation. It's so affirming of all the work that we're doing.
And I think we asked for this at the retreat, that you do this at this committee, so thank mm-hmm. you for that. So before we have any comments or questions, I want to get to the public speaker before we end. Yeah. So Mr. LeBron.
So thank you, Sebastian. There's enough material here, I think, for a workshop, and I guess you can see the writing on the wall. It's all unfolding. And some of us have been warning you about this for years. This is not the path we're on right now is not going to work. Let me give you some examples. You plan for Gilroy, you're going to have a shuttle. You don't measure Morgan Hill and Shuttle by looking at housing and jobs. What you do is you look at the freeway within 5 miles of any of the stations and you look at the traffic counts. What you're going to discover is that the traffic is not coming from Santa Clara County, it's coming from San Benito, it's coming from Santa Cruz into Silicon Valley. We're now at the point when it's 120,000 single-occupant vehicle in each direction every day. It is a catastrophe. You keep on hearing about Valley Lane and the Central Valley. We have 20% higher than that. You're not addressing this with a shuttle. There's no way people are going to move, Chief. It's useless. Crowding. We warned you about the standard cars. Buying more standard cars is not going to resolve the problem. We need double length platforms at some of the stations. They're either going to be 700 or 1400 feet, but I would say at least five of the stations need double length platforms. Diridon, Mountain View, Sunnyvale, Palo Alto, Redwood City is impossible to do down there. Look at Redwood Junction, for crying out loud, and Transbay. We need double-length platforms in Transbay. Now, times. San Jose, San Francisco is 70 minutes. This is not going to work. The expectation is Gilroy to San Francisco in 60 minutes. Now, you come in 4 trains an hour. This is the problem goes back to San Mateo. It's totally San Mateo-centric. If you live in San Mateo, you're within 30 minutes of San Francisco or 30 minutes of San Jose. But what you don't understand is that the majority of the demand is from San Francisco to Silicon Valley. Actually, that's what Supervisor Peskin calls it. You know, downtown there's an extension. He calls that Silicon Valley Connection. It's very simple. And by the way, Governor Newsom is in Transbay right now. So you're going to be hearing about this in the news this evening. There is no plans in there to increase the speed about 79 miles an hour. You're just seeing this, quite frankly, is a light rail pattern in San Mateo County. This is the vision that I'm seeing there. So moving forward, my recommendation to you is to go out to the private sector, issue an RFP.
Mr. LeBron, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to ask you to finish
and
up.
And maybe pull Virgin.
Okay. Any quick comments from the board in the 3 minutes we have left, since you have the hard stop, Director?
Yeah, Travis? I just want to first thank you to staff, but the other is that I want to dig in a little bit more to just understand the restrictions and options relative to Gilroy. I know you've tried to educate me about that, and every time I hear this presentation, I can feel my heart like sort of stopping. So I need to understand that better because, well, anyway, for obvious reasons. And perhaps before we have the next big presentation, I just can get an opportunity to talk to staff to dig in a little bit. Thank you.
Director Brinkman.
No other comments. Just thank you so much.
Yeah, amazing.
All right. Thank you very much for your help for your presentation. Next up, we have item 9, committee member requests. Are there any? Seeing none, item 10 is the date and time of the next regular WIPLIP committee meeting. We really need a better name. February 26, 2020 at 3 p.m. right here in this same building. And we are now adjourned.
Thank you.
Done. We are a group of chatty Cathys, aren't we?
Fascinating.
Yeah, it is. But these are really intense. Yeah, no, that's right.
We could have done a lot more in this last one, too.
Yeah. But it was good to get that, just to kind of get the lay of the land.
All right, my dear.